Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 343 of Registry Matters. Larry, we're slightly older than you are now.
Not much, but a little bit.
How are you tonight?
Doing awesome. Looking forward to a fantastic experience with your plans here.
My plans. let's just dive right in. We do have a guest. So tell me what are we doing tonight?
Well, Chance was unable to join this week due to a conflict, and this means it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom. But the good news is we have a guest, special guest from the Buckeye State of Ohio with us. We plan to go over some basics of legislative process with the hopes this information will make it less daunting for those who want to influence public policy in their own states. And we also are going to dive a little bit into a bill that's pending in the Ohio Assembly right now.
Fabulous. So let's see here. So like you said, it's House Bill 102 from the state of Ohio, and with our special guest. I'm going to introduce him real quick, and then we'll cover some questions, and then we'll hear from him in a few moments. But we have Joseph Zaricki. Did I pronounce that right?
Absolutely.
Fantastic. All right, and he's on the board with Ohio RSOL. He's the interim coordinator for the LAT, which that's not a workout acronym for your LATs. That's the Legislative Advocacy Team. He's an engineer and enjoys playing sports. But before we get into the weeds of House Bill 102, I'd like to go through some basics of how the system works. Are you up for that, Larry?
I hope so. If I'm not, I'm in deep trouble.
So let's begin by saying that I think it's a common perception that all elected officials are crooks seeking personal gain. And how do you respond to that?
Oh, that's easy. Nonsense.
All right.
The Ohio legislature has 132 members, and that is when those seats are vacant. And some of those 132 are likely motivated by less than honorable reasons. But most are good, decent individuals hoping to contribute to having a better society for their communities and their constituents.
I got to think back to the individual named Gabby Gifford. I'm assuming you know who that is?
Yes.
I can't imagine that she would have joined. She was at the U.S., the federal level, wasn't she? She wasn't state level, correct?
I'm not sure about what her bio entails.
Well, I'm just her elected position. Anyway, she was then just doing like in a parking lot, doing like a town hall in a parking lot, and someone decided to shoot her, and the bullet went through, and she lived through it. But I just can't imagine that she joined being like, I just don't see it that way. So how can you say that with a straight face when everybody knows that they're all crooks, Larry? Come on, you know they're all crooks.
Well, I remember she got shot before I answer the question, and I remember that she was a member of Congress, correct?
U.S. I believe so.
House Representative. But I don't know what her background was other than that, and I think state of Arizona is where she was from. But how can you pose such a question without any evidence? Who is everyone? I'm someone, and I don't know that.
Well, no, you are definitely not someone. And it's the committee of they, of course. It's always the they, right?
Right.
Okay. So, but my research shows that the current base pay for a member of the Ohio House and Senate is almost $71,100 a year, which is identified as a part-time job. They make $70,000 a year part-time. Also, many legislators are paid more because of salary supplements for chairing committees and et cetera, other things. My research also shows that the median household income in Ohio is only $67,000. So these cats with part-time jobs make more than the average income. And the source of that is the Census Bureau. So how can you justify that salary for a part-time job? That doesn't seem fair.
I can't because I don't live in Ohio. But this is for the voters of Ohio to decide. I can say that Ohio is under solid Republican control, and we all know that that party would never fleece the taxpayers. In fact, they are the fiscally responsible party, and they're the guardians of the purse, are they not?
Now, I have to hand it to you, Larry. That was pretty funny.
By the way, our legislators here in New Mexico do not receive any salary they receive roughly about $200 per day and per diem when they're in session and or attending legislative meetings throughout the year. And if you milk it for all it's worth in a session that has a 60-day session, if you get yourself assigned to enough interim committees, you might can milk it for about maybe 24,000 here.
But shouldn't they just...
Those are per diem payments. They're not, that's not salary.
But shouldn't they do it out of the goodness of their own heart? For the goodness of the people?
Well, if they could figure out how to make a living, but see, if you are going to take off part of the year to work on behalf of the people, and you have to go to Santa Fe, which is an expensive city, for lodging accommodations, they don't have a dormitory for the lawmakers. They have to find housing. They have to eat. So you say that they should lose their employment, their income. They should go pay money out of their pocket for lodging, and they should get absolutely nothing.
I'm in my head, I'm making a comparison to someone that is in the reserves, the military reserves, and the, you know, at least for like the 2 weeks out of the year that they do their active duty service. I mean, you just got to think that their employer would be like, I understand where you're going, and I'm not going to hold it against you, and your job would be here. Granted, that's only 2 weeks, not for 2 months, like you're saying. But wouldn't you then possibly say that their employer should hold the spot? Like that would be their duty on the other side of that?
Well, they often do hold the spot, but they don't pay them a salary. And they have children, and they have mortgage payments, and they have all sorts of college tuition and everything else that the normal individuals have. And oftentimes, they have their own business. They're a lawyer or a dentist. And if they take off of their business for 2 months to go serve the people, so they close down their dental practice, their kids still need to eat, mortgage still needs to be paid. They get to pay $150 a day if they're lucky to find housing in Santa Fe. And they should do it out of their own pocket, really?
All right. Well, do you have a couple or three key points that would improve the odds of success for the newbies that are going down and trying to talk to legislators?
Wow. Only three?
Yeah, three.
If I only have three, I would say to begin with, first, you need to have a very positive attitude when making contact. If you can't hide your disdain for the process, you're pretty much doomed to failure. So if you go in saying that you guys are nothing but a bunch of crooks and I can't stand the sight of you, it's very unlikely they're going to want to work with you. Second, you need to know how the process works and be very sensitive to the political realities of whatever the situation is. And when I say know how the system works, I'm not going to pick on Ohio because they're our guest, but I can pick on another state of Nebraska. I was trying to help them a decade ago. And they didn't know just the very basics of stuff that they should have known. They didn't know that interim committees were open to the public. They did not know that there's a system there in Nebraska and they're unicameral that all bills that have been prioritized by a legislator, meaning that they get a certain number of priorities that they can use to say, I want this bill to be heard. The committee is obligated that it's been assigned to hear it. They didn't know any of that stuff. And so I'm trying to help them as an outsider. And I told them, you know, I rely on you locals to know basic stuff because I'm looking at it from a distance and I'm giving you broad concepts. I need you to tell me how the sausage is made there. So it's very important you know how the process works and what the political situation is, the reality of the political situation. If you don't follow the news, if you don't watch what's happening, if you don't listen to what's happening, you're not going to know what the political realities are in your state. But third, you need to be very informed on the subject matter and be very concise with your talking points. This means, folks, I hate to break it to you, throwing your reams of recidivism data into the dumpster. And as a newbie, you will not be taken seriously when you walk in with reams of documents. In fact, you will be classified as a nut and someone to avoid if you do that.
Did you just say you should throw away the recidivism studies? You should put them in the dumpster?
Yes, if you are going in as a rookie lobbyist with people you don't know in a system that you barely understand, and you go in with voluminous amounts of data, they will certify you immediately as being a nut.
How do you keep them from certifying you as being a nut?
Well, they've certified me many years ago.
Very good. Let's get on to House Bill 102. What can you tell us about the legislation? Can we back up even one step before that? Sometimes they say HB, sometimes they say SB. We covered something recently where there was some completely foreign thing that you didn't even know it was, but what are HB and SB?
Well, those are easy, House bill and Senate bill, but sometimes there's legislative bill, like in California, there's LB and there's all these different things. And again, that's for the locals to know. I can't possibly keep track of all that for the whole country.
So then tell us about the legislation going on there.
Well, I'd prefer to let the guest describe the proposal a bit later in the segment. I can say its primary sponsor is Representative Roy Klopfenstein, who represents House District 82. The other lead sponsor is Representative Josh Williams, who represents House District 44. And that's got to be one of the most gerrymandered districts I've ever seen in my 184 years on Earth.
I mean, I can't believe that that's the worst.
Well, it's probably not the worst, but if you look at, it's around Toledo, and they didn't want to, being that he's a Republican, they didn't want to try to put the urban part in. So when they were drawing the district, they knew in order to win, they needed to be a suburbia. So they drew this map, and it goes as a horseshoe around the outskirts of Toledo. So you look at it on the left, and it goes underneath Toledo and a bit back around to the
Jesus.
Right.
Jesus, okay. I gotcha. Yeah. But that's not to say that the left or the right, the blue or the red, neither is the more, well, I shouldn't say that. I have evidence that says one is more guilty than the other one, but they both do it, correct?
That is correct. Absolutely. I'm shocked that you would even accuse the majority of Ohio of gerrymandering their legislative districts. They're pure as the wind-driven snow. But anyway, I'd prefer to let Josh summarize the legislation if he can.
Welcome.
Yeah, I can do that. Oh, welcome. Thank you for having me. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, perfect.
So the core provisions of Ohio House Bill 102, it expands housing and movement restrictions for individuals listed on the sex offender list. And so it includes residency and loitering restrictions. So registered individuals cannot live within 2,000 feet of their victim's current residence. They also can't loiter within 1,000 feet of their victim's home. And somebody can bring a civil injunction. It can be the victim. It can be their landlord. It can be nearby property owners. It could be a prosecutor. It could be a mayor. It could really be anybody. And if they go get this injunctive relief, it doesn't require them to prove that there's been any harm. And so you can just be evicted.
Larry, where should we go from that? Is that a decent summary to kick things off?
I think so. I was really confused. I read the 22-page legislation, and when you read it, Ohio appears to draft it like most of the states do, where they underscore the new material. And so I looked more carefully at the new material, because the existing material is not up for debate. It's already law. And I was looking at the new material, and it didn't look like to me that it's a criminal affair. It looks like to me, when they use the term injunction, that's a civil action, an injunction. And then it doesn't say that they're subject to any penalties in terms of prison. It doesn't, and it seems to delegate, as was described by the guest, anybody can enforce, you know, town officials and whatnot. So it seems to be a very confusing piece of legislation. So my job here is not to know all the details of the legislation. My job is to help you figure out how to fight it. So, but I was very confused about some of the stuff I saw in the bill and the way it was drafted. And it looks very bizarre, to say the least.
So what happened here, Larry, is that, if I may, go ahead.
Go.
There was a particular instance that happened in the bill sponsor's district, where a constituent came to him because a returning citizen had victimized the neighbor, who was a minor child, and the returning citizen returned back to that same house where they had lived before. And so they called up their legislator and said, we need to do something about this, and that legislator proposed this bill.
So but in terms of the, I understand that part, but I don't understand what the bill, the way it's written, who it empowers and what the penalty is for not complying. The penalty is an injunction that you'll have to move. But since it's a civil injunction, who does what if you say, well, you can take your injunction and use it for TP, then what? So like I say, there's a lot of stuff I don't understand in the bill. So I'm not pretending I'm an expert at all, because this is really blowing my mind, and I've been doing this for decades.
We also have some Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say that there's information where this was a bill in that's been passed in Oklahoma, I believe, and maybe a couple other states. And that wasn't 100% clear to me, but that's what I understand.
I was going to go over some more procedural stuff about how the makeup of the legislative body, how that matters. So can you explain why it matters? Who's in control? And like we were just talking about gerrymandering, and this applies to that, but it also applies just in general. Who wins the election? Who has the majority? Why does that matter?
Okay, the makeup of the Ohio legislature, the Senate has a membership of 33, and 24 of them are Republicans and 9 are Democrats. The House has a makeup of 99 members, 65 are Republicans and 34 Democrats. This means, folks, you're totally wasting your time. Trust me, you're wasting your time if you go lobby a single Democrat. They cannot pass anything, nor can they kill anything. So you'd be better off to go out and chip away at concrete, and you get more satisfaction than I'm talking to a Democrat. But and that goes in the case when it's flipped over in California, you're wasting your time to try to talk to a Republican because they're such a minuscule minority there. But what it does when you have the majority, why it's important, is because the process keeps the majority controls the legislative process. The majority basically runs the legislative process by turning the makeup, but they determine who's on the committees. And the majority will chair all the committees, not part of them, all of them. So if you look at your list of Ohio committee chairs, you won't see a single Democrat chairing any of them because they're not in the majority. That means that the committee calendars are controlled by the majority. What bills get heard are controlled by the majority. That means if you're in the minority and you'd like your bill to get heard, you can play what we played in the beginning again, because that's what will happen to your legislation if the majority doesn't like it. So that's why it's so important. It's not a process by which equal power is shared. It's based on your ratio. So if you have 70% of the seats, you have 70% of the committee membership. So you're going to take a 10-member committee and you're going to give 7 of the seats to the majority party and 3 of them to the minority party. It's pretty straightforward. So political control is everything.
Joe, you had a question?
No.
All right. Well, Larry, I've heard you say that it would behoove not just us, but all states to formulate a relationship with the legislative policy analysts. I don't know that I've really heard a whole lot about that, especially the fiscal analysts.
Yes, both are important. The policy analyst, if I had to rate them, that would be a little bit more important, but they're both important. And that's correct. But if you don't understand the process, then it's not going to get you anywhere if you don't understand that process. Because I tried to get the senator to give me a recent analyst report, and he said that they hand them out in person. They don't email them, because if they'd email them, I would have dozens of them. But I've been privileged to look at a few of them by lawmakers who trust me, and they say, this is what the committee analyst has told us. Give me some talking points to rebut this. It's important that you have influence over that analyst report, because those people are just like you and me. They don't want to do any work. And I mean, who wakes up every day that you know in your life that says, I can't wait to go do a whole bunch of work? Can you name anybody that comes to mind?
I mean, I like waking up and going to work, Larry. Maybe I'm the weird one.
Well, very few people like to do work they don't have to do.
It's mowing the lawn, I would rather not do that.
And so therefore, when they get a piece of legislation, most of them who do the analytical work are oftentimes attorneys, not always, but they're very deep-rooted in public policy, but you can't know everything about everything. So they appreciate being provided solid, reliable information that's not biased by someone who has an axe to grind. So if you form relationships with the analyst, then you can influence what goes in the reports that the lawmakers see. And that's where the most important thing happens, because these lawmakers, when you see them in a committee, when they're asking questions, they didn't think up most of these questions. They were provided to them by analyst reports and by trusted constituents, by lobbyists who provided these questions and concerns. And they sit there and read off what they've been provided, and they look very brilliant, but they don't do this stuff themselves.
Can we dig into that even more? Talk about analysts more?
Sure. Well, each state, to my knowledge, and I've assisted in a number of states, they have analysts who are responsible for conducting research around a specific bill. And Tammy, thank you for writing this up for me, because I took what you wrote up of my conversation and I pasted it in here. And no legislator has the time to read through all the jargon and the bills, which is where the analysts fit in. Analysts sometimes are in the legislative offices, and sometimes they're specifically assigned to a committee, depending on the structure in each state. Again, you locals have to figure this out, how it works. But typically, larger committees will have more, and analysts and smaller committees will have less, or may even be assigned one analyst. Like a committee that doesn't get very many bills referred to it, they're going to have very little analyst support. And the states that are more generous, they'll have, to be fair, they'll give analysts to the majority and to the minority. And again, I don't know how Ohio does that, but being they have such lopsided majorities, that if they do give analysts to the Democrats, they're not giving them very many because of the lopsided majorities they have. But having relationships with these analysts can prove very advantageous, because if they believe what they're being provided with, that they're being provided factual, non-biased research, it's very beneficial for them. They have less work to do. And for example, the 4 pages of talking points that were provided to me, this would be great stuff to provide to an analyst that trusts you. You provide this to a legislator, it's going into the garbage can because they don't have time to read it. And so if you're going to provide this to a legislator, you need to pare it down to 2 or 3 key points. But 4 pages of brilliantly written stuff is not unlikely to be read, because you're one of dozens of people that are grabbing them and saying, I want you to take a look at this. Trust me, that's what happens.
I've always thought that the legislators drafted their own bills. So how do bills get drafted?
That's a great question, because it is a common misconception. They seldom draft anything. The senator I worked for the last dozen years was one of the rarities that drafted his own legislation. But he didn't actually do the final draft. He would do the rough draft. And then we call it legislative council service here. But in Ohio, the bills are drafted by the Legislative Service Commission. And we provided a link to that for those who want to go see what all the Legislative Service Commission does. Again, I don't know how that system works in Ohio, because I've not practiced there. Generally here, there are attorneys that work for legislative counsel. They understand our statutory schemes, where things belong, how not to draft something where it conflicts with other existing similar laws on the same subject area. You wouldn't want to have too many conflicts pop up in your law. So those attorneys that are on legislative counsel, or in this case, Ohio Legislative Service Commission, they do the drafting. So usually what happens, Joe, is the lawmaker calls up council service or legislative service commission, in your case, and they say, I want a bill that'll do this. And tell me more, representative. Well, I want it to do this, this, and this. Okay, and they're taking notes, and they say, okay, I'll draft you something. And then in my 12 years of working in the Senate, supporting the senator, I would see the rough drafts, because those are sent to the lawmaker who requested them. Here, it's all confidential. Unless you open the file, unless the lawmaker who's got the file open wants to let someone in, then it's a confidential relationship between the staff attorney and the legislator. They draft it up. They go back and forth. When the lawmaker is happy with it, or if the lawmaker can't get happy, oftentimes they'll bring in an expert like me on the subject area of PFR registration. The lawmaker here that has sponsored bills that I've wanted, he just tells leg counsel, go ahead and work directly with Larry. Whatever he tells you is what I want in the bill. So that's a great situation when you have a lawmaker who designates you as a contact person for that bill, because then you get what you want the way you want it, mostly.
Okay, great. Thanks for the clarification. So Larry, you know, earlier you discussed it's important to know the particular nuances of the state legislator and the legislature and the bill process, you know, getting to know how the sausage is made, as you put it. So if we don't have that, if an affiliate group out there doesn't have that particular institutional knowledge in the state, how do we get that? Do we just go down and try? Do we just make a bunch of phone calls? Do we go down there and try it out and learn over time? What's the best way to do that?
That's a good question, because see, I did it over decades, and it's hard for me to pinpoint easily. But knowing how the process has evolved over those decades that I've been doing it, I would tell you that the website is a great resource. You can track a lot and learn a lot, because all the rules, I checked your website, all the rules, you know, of the legislative process are there on the website. But that only goes so far. There's things in writing, and then there's how it works in real life. And I would strongly suggest that you try to find time to have a regular person who's reasonably articulate, easy on the eyes. I mean, you send somebody in with screws and bolts and tattoos from head to toe and a trench coat, you're probably not going to get a great reception in a professional. All the lawmakers here are required to wear coats and ties and stuff. And it's a very professional, formal process. So don't go in with screws and bolts and sandals and stuff like that and expect to be taken seriously. If you want to be considered a joke, go ahead and do that. But hang out in the process, particular committees, watching how committees work, learning the nuances of the chairs of the committee, how they run their show. Yeah, if they roll things over to another day, that's one of the greatest games we play here. Is I'll get with a committee chair and I'll say, man, this is a bad bill. It is so bad that the two worst points about it are X, Y. But it's so bad, can you just sit on the damn thing for me for a couple of days, few days, to help me stall out time? Because our sessions are tightly run in a limited number of days. 60 is the longest session we have. If I can get a committee chair to sit on a bill for a few days and not schedule it, can you see what I've done in terms of possibly running out the clock? If it's got to go through four committees, which is the way we run this process here, and I can get a chair to hold a bill up for 4 or 5 days, you see what it does?
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Joe, do you want to go over some of the things that you guys are going to do in Ohio, and maybe Larry could kind of critique and see if that would be a decent way to go?
Okay, so the way that our legislative advocacy team works is, first, we in Ohio, we have something called My Legislature, and you can sign up for notifications in your email when a bill is introduced that hits certain subject areas. And so we as a group have several people that go and look at that legislation. It comes into their email, and then we go read it and figure out how, if it pertains to our group. And then we bring it to our larger team through email and say to everybody, what do you think about this bill? Do you have a particular position on it? And then if we decide that we want to take a position on it, now we look at our shared values. We come up with brainstorm some talking points. And then we go ahead and write an article to try to put that on our website so that people that are going down to testifying, we put out a call to action, basically, saying, if you're a member of Ohio RSAW, look at this bill. We need to do something about this. We give them a set of talking points, and then they go and testify. What do you think, Larry?
That's a very sophisticated process if it works. I would never be able to perfect such a process because I don't have the resources here of people who would be involved at that level. But I don't have any real fault with the process. But it does tend to decentralize authority. On behalf of RSOL Ohio, on our typical subject areas that we want to be in opposition or in support of legislation, you're probably a lot more opposed than you are to things that are put out that are favorably. You're not likely to be favorably inclined to anything that's introduced, I would think. But you tend to run the risk of mixed messaging quite a bit and inconsistent messaging. and they don't know who to look to as the authority. If you take a look at how big entities, whether it be the telephone industry, whether it be the oil industry, you're not going to have a group of people that show up on behalf of Exxon Mobil. You're going to have one high dollar lobbyist that's going to show up on behalf of Exxon Mobil. And in fact, you may have one high dollar lobbyist that shows up on behalf of the entire industry of oil production and extraction. So you run a lot of risk with that kind of game because you just can't keep a consistent message going. And it's very important when you mix message and confuse the lawmakers, it's very debilitating. Example, we had a standalone bill back in my naive days about 20 years ago that I thought we could pass to prohibit residency restrictions. And we believed in this group lobbying thing because we have had a guy here named Lloyd at that time that believed that we should take throngs of people to the Capitol. And so we had people standing up, speaking on behalf of New Mexico RSOL, and they were hearing messages that were inconsistent and conflicting. One person stood up and said residency restrictions were not a bad idea if they were uniquely tailored to the right individuals, which totally destroyed my message that residency restrictions should never be done because it deprives people of the right to live where they want to live, to be where they want to be, and it deprives landlords of being able to make decisions. It interferes with capitalist practices. I mean, I know a pro-business state like Ohio would never want to interfere with the private sector's decisions of being able to pick and choose their tenants. I mean, they're the party of liberty, right?
That's what I hear.
Absolutely.
So I had that type of messaging. And then I had a person stand up and say, well, they're okay if they're only applied to certain, basically the bad guys. Then I had a lawmaker that approached me afterwards and he said, I was inclined to support your bill until I started hearing conflicting stories. He says, who do we put these residence restrictions on? Who are the right people? And I realized that taking in a group of people, you can't keep them all on the same page.
Thank you for that. That makes a lot of sense.
Very good. What do you think, Larry, about having like everyone that is a part of a NARSOL affiliate doing like a zombie walk and sending a huge number of people down to the Capitol to lobby?
Not generally a good idea for the foregone reasons I said about the risk of inconsistent messaging, but it can be an effective tool if done like the way the major organizations do, like the National Rifle Association, the people who believe in a woman's right to choose abortion, and those who believe in a woman doesn't have such a right. You can bring that, you can descend on the Capitol with throngs of people that have no intention of speaking, and they have signs and they walk around, and they can be very compelling because it conveys to them that this is an important issue. So if you were to take a throng of PFRs and their families, and particularly the adolescent minors, to the Capitol with messages, I want to be with my dad on the sign. The law won't let me be with my father. If you did that, that could be effective, but it's generally not a good idea.
And then what about like letter writing campaigns? Or I know that your favorite is to have email sent, especially if they're all the same.
I do advise affiliates to refrain from providing a form letter for advocates to use because, again, I worked in a Senate support role for 12 years. I watched what came in this office, and we developed a protocol of how we handle that. We had a protocol. The first time or two, you screwed me and you fooled me because I thought you had done some work yourself. But when I got like the third email that had the exact same language in it, I contacted the boss. I said, you know, we're getting form emails from this particular bill about this particular bill. He would go into the tech side and he would create a spam filter, and we would divert every one of those emails to spam. Because if you didn't take the time to write anything, if you were going to simply click on a link and follow it, and oftentimes they wouldn't even take the time to figure out if they were sending it to a senator or to a representative. It would just say, dear representative/senator. I'm thinking, what kind of moron would do this? So right. when I got stuff like that, I would immediately institute a spam filter on those. And I can't speak for other offices other than tell you that they did it. I will tell you that we did it, and we told people we were doing it. We would call I would have the senator if it got too bombarding, because it would throw us off the air, particularly with the heavy use like the NRA and people like that. If he was intending to vote one way, he would call the lobbyist when they started bombarding us. He would say, "I was about to support your bill. I was about to oppose your bill. But if you don't kill this shit, I'm going to vote the other way, because you're knocking my office off the air."
You can't use that language on this family-oriented program.
So electronic submissions, if you're going to compose it yourself, do it. If you're going to follow a form letter, put it in the wastebasket where I told you what to do with your reams of recidivism stuff.
Let's get back to House Bill 102, and I know that our guest is furiously typing away to ask a question here in a little bit. If a state can bring a group to the Capitol, what do you recommend to prevent mixed messages?
Well, remember, I don't know the Ohio process, which makes my advice somewhat iffy. If it were here, I'd simply say have a dozen people who are ready to testify, and since we don't want to waste your time, this is what I'd be conveying to the assembly, to the committee. And I would probably convey it to the committee chair, or at least to the committee secretary, but prior to the committee meeting convening. And I'd say we have all these individual testimonies that we can give, but we would prefer to provide a few points that represent the group. And that's what I would recommend people do, is if your process allows that, you convey to the committee chair, committee secretary, that you've got 15 people here, and we realize time is compact and tight, and they're in opposition to the bill. And if it pleases the chair, here are our key opposition points. And then the committee chair will likely hear from one or two of the people, and then you need to have the best particular person you can do the speaking. And you've also shown respect, understanding of the process, and they really will appreciate that. And that's kind of the direction I take here.
Let me ask you this question. I'll give you a chance in a second, Joe. Give me 1 moment. Georgia has a process. It's called like Legislative Day at the Capitol. I forgot the exact name. And that's where it seems like all of the advocacy groups go in, and then the legislative body is also expecting to be interrupted during their sessions and all that stuff. Do you have to be more active than that kind of one-day thing to go in and bring all of your people in where they can go talk to their legislator, their senator, and all that stuff? Is that effective enough to go in and try and talk to them?
I guess that question got a little confusing to me toward the end about can you sharpen it a little bit?
I can try. So, like I said, I only did this once, and boy, and my other question to you is going to be, I was nervous as crap to talk to my representative, but they have this Justice Day at the Capitol, and I believe that it's designed where all of the advocacy groups are there, and then by exchange, all of the legislative body is also expecting there to be a bunch of interruptions to go talk to their constituent out in the hallway. Is that enough to be effective in supporting or opposing? And I'm sure we're mostly opposing, but is that going to be enough to sway how they're going to vote when it comes down to it?
Honestly, my experience in life tells me if you haven't done the work necessary beforehand, very few people change their vote based on what they hear at committee. Very few. It does happen. But
That they've already decided what they're going to vote somewhere prior to all of that?
Yes, they know which way they're leaning because they've got the analyst report. The people that are trained professional lobbyists have already contacted them. They've already bent their ears. They already have a predisposition because, as a general rule, law enforcement-oriented people are going to be more conservative, and they already know that they're going to typically support something law enforcement's for. So they've already got a bias when the bill starts being heard. And if you haven't convinced them that they should deviate from that bias before you get there, there's very little you're going to say that's going to change their mind. If they're cops supporters, they're not going to say, "Oh, well, I heard this, and it makes all the difference," because it doesn't.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I mean, Larry, that's absolutely what I was just going to ask you. You know, if you're going to testify, is there something that you need to do beforehand? And is it too late once you go to testify? And then once you do testify, what should you do after?
Well, that's a series of questions. Now, what the process may vary there. Your mileage may vary, as Andy says. Here, if you want the entire committee to have your talking points, you have to give them, there's a deadline for handouts because the committee secretary is going to be the one who distributes those things and puts them in their binders. And they usually need them in advance before the hearing convenes, that committee meeting before it convenes. So you've prepped the committee secretary, at least, that you've got handouts and they're in their binders on their desk. And you've talked to lawmakers on the committee if you have such relationships. I'm generally going to go to the chair or the vice chair of the committee. But you may not have that access because Ohio has five times the population New Mexico does, and you have one-tenth of the experience I have of building relationships. So between having five times as much population and one-tenth of the experience, you may not have the access that I have. But I'm just going to go straight to the committee chair, vice chair, or the secretary and say, here's what I've got. And I'm going to take full advantage of my 3 minutes or whatever they allow to make a verbal presentation, or this is all I care to do. I'm going to ask this to be put in a binder, and I'm going to sit down and say nothing. So they generally know if I'm going to say anything, and I tend not to want to say anything in public because it's all streamed across the entire planet. It's archived, and then the media comes in and grabs that later because it's available under Inspection of Public Records Act, and they vilify your organization later because you've testified in public and you said something they can twist and distort and take out a few words and make it different than what you actually said. So I lay low and work more on the backside where less experienced lobbyists and less connected lobbyists, they don't lay low. They're more relegated to having to do it on the front side. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Makes sense to me. Do you have time, Larry, to answer a question or two from people in chat?
Oh, I would love to answer some questions because that means I don't have to do any work. All I have to do is think.
Well, I think that's actually classified as work for some people. So Tammy asks, how effective can coalitions and nonprofits be if, of course, an idea is appealing to or for a lawmaker? And I think what she's trying to say is that if, like, they have the victims advocates super duper and they're on board with them, and you go in there and you're trying to, like, hey, can we stop this bill? But they're already very in favor of the bill. How can we, as nonprofits and our coalitions, how can we help push or move these things around?
That's a good question, Tammy J. What you have to do, in my experience, is to come up with something that no one can argue against as a talking point. And I'll give you an example on my first PFR reform bill that I got through the legislative process here, which Governor Susana Martinez vetoed just to teach me not to be arrogant, because I had some things in there I thought should have been in there that were really too controversial. And it was my naivete that caused the veto, because I got a little bit too big for my britches, as they say in the South. But what you can do, back to the question, is you need to have something that's very compelling. So I wanted to stop residency restrictions from being possible because I didn't want the runaway control competition between the counties and the cities. And I don't even know if Ohio has residency restrictions. So Ohio have residency restrictions. This might not make any sense to you guys. Do you have residency restrictions locally imposed there? Okay,
yes,
we have forbidden them by law. Well, but my first reaction from the conservative side of the aisle, which is about a third or a little bit more than a third of our lawmakers here, they said, Larry, I can't vote for this. And I said, I know this goes against your grain. I know you believe that the locals are closer to the public. You have to vindicate them in their views. And you sneakily call them out on the hypocrisy. I said, I know you believe wholeheartedly that locals govern best and they know best. But if you don't get on board with this bill, here's what's going to happen. And I'm trying to empower him, this particular Republican leader, to give his caucus the green light to go ahead and not try to kill my bill. I said, what you tell your constituents is that if you don't vote for this, this is to protect you in our rural parts of the state from Albuquerque's voluminous amount of sex offenders that will move to your area. And I said, if you don't vote for this, we can start drawing circles. And we've got a whole lot more things to circle than you do in your rural area. So you tell your constituents that you had to support this because Albuquerque and Las Cruces and Santa Fe were going to dump their sex offenders out on you. And he said, that's what I needed. He said, my caucus will not oppose you on that. And so that's what you've got to do. You've got to come up with something that they can't disagree with. Like on your bill, the first thing I would go in would be the most ridiculous thing that you would ever think of. I'd go in and I'd say, well, now, wait a minute. I'm trying to understand this. And I'm looking at it very carefully. It says that no sex offender shall no one who's on the registry, their name will appear, however it's worded, they said, shall knowingly live within the range of their victim. I'm going to say, well, you know, I've got a problem here because from a legal point of view, the only way that they could know that, since victims are not required to be on a public registry, we're going to have to require the victim to stay in touch with the offender so that the offender will not violate this. And do you see the problem that we have right away? This is going to have all sorts of unintended consequences, because how will the sex offender know that he or she is living within that range of the victim unless we require the victim? Now, I'm going to stand down on my opposition if you're amenable to an amendment that will require each victim to be in constant communication with the offender so that they can know where they're living.
AKA put them on a registry.
Oh, no, I wouldn't want to go that far. But see, that is the most asinine thing that you could say, but it will resonate with people, because when you start showing the absurdity and how complicated this is, that's when you're more likely to get someone to say, wait, I hadn't even thought of that. Everybody would come up with their reams of paper, and nobody would ever thought about that's what I would be doing here. I'd be saying, I don't see how this would ever work, because there's no way in the world that the sex offender is going to know where the victim is. They're not required to keep track of the victim. The victim's not required to stay in touch with the sex offender. In fact, they do just the opposite. They tell them that they're ordered to stay away from the victim. So what are we going to do here? How are we going to make this work?
I understand. I think that's a very clever, crafty way to sabotage something there.
So,
and then you would always then come back and say, well, if I can think of it, then they can think of it. But I don't know that that's necessarily true. Because even the Grandmaster Chess Wizards of the universe, they somehow bamboozle the other guy that's a Grand Wizard Chess Master across the table from them. They still figure out how to bamboozle them, and there's only the 16 pieces on the board, Larry.
Well, I don't have a clue what any of those pieces do, but I've been told it's a complicated game, but who knows? But this game is not that complicated. It really, it seems complicated until once you accept the basic premises of how it works. The basic concept that you have to understand is the people are in the driver's seat. And like Representative Klopfenstein, there's no reason for anyone to think sinister things about him. He's a farmer. He doesn't know anything about criminal law, civil law, for that matter, I don't think. He's a farmer. He represents some rural counties, I think, based on where it looks like. It looks like a very rural area. And he has no political ambitions in this because he's winning his elections. His last election, he beat the Democrats 79-21%. The election before that, he beat the Democrats 71-72% to whatever it was. He does not have any reason to be concerned about a Democrat posing him any problem. The only problem he has to worry about politically is to make sure that someone doesn't out-conservative him. Because he might get a primary challenge, which he's had the primary challenges, but they were not very effective when I look at his Ballotpedia history. But there's no reason for people to without any proof, to subscribe any sinister motivations to him. He was brought this by a constituent who asked him to do something, and he looked at it and said, oh, I'll have legislative, what do we call it, whatever that service is there. He said, I'll have them draft up something. He probably doesn't give a rat's ass if it passes or not. And looking at his passage rate, it's so minuscule low that you could probably stay asleep and this is not going to pass because he never gets anything out of the legislature anyway. But those are the kind of things you need to take a look at when you see a bill. You need to start figuring out who's sponsoring it, who do they represent, what is their motivation? Why are they bringing this forward? Well, I told Tammy before I even knew what was going on. I said, this was either K came about because a constituent brought it to him or victims advocacy apparatus brought it to him, saying that we need to do this, and maybe a combination of the two. And so I think right now I would approach him and say, you know, there's some real problems with this damn thing that no one's told you about. And throw your reams away and go and say the problems are, and give him two or three problems that makes this an ineffective and unworkable bill. He might say, okay, and he might just sit on it because the sponsor has to make the bill move. And a lot of people introduce bills with no intention of moving them whatsoever because they can put on their constituent communications that if you've ever read a letter from one of your elected officials, they're very prideful of how many bills they've introduced. They'll say, I co-sponsored. You notice the list is a whole lot smarter on what I passed and what was signed into law. If this guy's got anything signed into law, I'd sure like to know about it because I haven't been able to find it. So like I say, you could probably stay asleep and nothing's going to happen. But rather than run that risk, I would approach him and say, hey, you got some problems with the bill. Here's what I'd suggest to do, and maybe even offer him some amended language to fix the problems. But there's nothing to be thinking him being sinister or politically motivated. He's not. He's doing this because he believes in it.
Larry, we are running super long, and are we ready to close it all down? Because I think we're done.
Well, unless there's any more questions from chat, or unless Joe has anything else, I hope this has been a little bit helpful to you, Joe.
Larry, I think this has been great. I'd just like to say something about...
Go ahead and tell us about okay. RSOL Ohio.
Yeah, so in Ohio, we have 20,000 people on our registry, and needless to say, we do not have 20,000 Ohio RSOL members. So it would be great if you people in Ohio that are registry affected could go to ohrsol.com, donate, join. We're just a group of volunteers trying to make everyone's life a little bit better on the registry here.
And that's tell it. Me the URL again.
It's ohrsol.com.
Very good. Fantastic. Larry, I don't think we have time to do anything else, to be honest with you.
I'm happy. If you don't think there's any more time, I'm happy to end it now. And I'm glad that we were able to put this episode together because I hope it's helpful not only to Ohio, but to other states who want to be effective.
It's got to be at least roughly similar from state to state what you described.
Roughly it is.
Yeah. Well, as we normally say at this point, head over to registrymatters.co and you can find show notes and links to go everywhere else, including email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Leave old-fashioned voicemail at 747-227-4477. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/registrymatters. And you can find other links. Oh, I can't forget about the swag. Head over to fypeducation/shop. Oh, with fypeducation.org/shop. And there are t-shirts and other things that you can pick up there, including our famous Kabuki machine shirt. And you'll see all that stuff at the conference in Ohio. It's hard to think and do a podcast at the same time, Larry.
Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yes, we are. So in another time we'll do Ohio again, I'm sure. Thanks so much, Larry. I appreciate all of your insight. I think this is incredibly useful. This is like a more nuts and bolts kind of episode. And again, Joe, thank you for joining us. And I hope you have your email box is completely overflowing with correspondence from the 20,000 people in Ohio. Thanks for joining us, my friend.
Yeah. Thank you. See you at the conference.
Thank you for being a patron. And I'll see you at the conference as well. Have a great night, everybody. Thanks.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.
That's what I...